From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. In a refugee camp in Darfur, Sudan, there is hunger, death, and yet dignity. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Rowan Gillies, international president of Doctors Without Borders, who was recently in Darfur. He'll tell us about the people he met there, their stories of brutality and rape, and the challenges he faces in confronting a growing humanitarian crisis. Also, we discuss the origins of the conflict with John Prendergast, co-director of the Africa Program for the International Crisis Group. He also advised the U.S. State Department on Sudan policy. He recently traveled to villages in rebel-held areas there. The crisis in Sudan, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Fighting between U.S. troops and Iraqi Shiite militiamen has reportedly died down in the southern city of Najaf. Earlier today, the Shiite holy city was rocked by dozens of explosions and small arms fire. NPR's Iraqi interpreter, Ali Favel, was there as the fighting peaked.
It seems some of them come from tanks, because the tanks, two streets, you can hear now the sound of one of the tanks near to us shooting towards that market. In fact, also you can see and you can hear some gunfiring, firefighting going on also. And you can see now a very heavy airstrike going on. In fact, the smell is going on all over the Najaf. Something like a very big fire is going on.
The Shiite militia fighters are loyal to rebellious Muslim cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry is accusing President Bush of using a surrogate to question the honors Kerry won during the Vietnam War. At a firefighters' convention in Boston, Kerry referred to TV ads run by a group called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
They're funded by hundreds of thousands of dollars from a Republican contributor out of Texas. They're a front for the Bush campaign. And the fact that the president won't denounce what they're up to tells you everything that you need to know. He wants them to do his dirty work.
Kerry received 5 medals for his service in Vietnam, including Purple Hearts and a Silver Star. The negative ads suggest that he exaggerated his actions to win the medals. Bush-Cheney campaign spokesman Steve Schmidt denies Kerry's charge.
The Bush-Cheney campaign has no involvement with this group. And Senator Kerry knows that. And his baseless attack is really one reason why I think he has a growing credibility problem with a lot of American voters.
Bush-Cheney campaign spokesman Steve Schmidt, the president, has not denounced the ads. Consumer advocate and presidential candidate Ralph Nader is moving closer to getting his name on the November ballot in the key battleground state of Ohio. Bill Cohen reports from Ohio Public Radio.
Nader supporters have filed more than 14,000 petition signatures to get his name on the Ohio ballot. And even if many are thrown out as invalid, he has a good shot. Only 5,000 names are needed. Democratic Party leaders call a vote for Nader a vote for President Bush. They've hired a lawyer to scrutinize every name for irregularities, with an eye toward blocking Nader from the ballot. Nader supporters brush aside as irrelevant the scenario that has Nader siphoning votes from John Kerry and helping President Bush retain the White House. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost 42 points to close at 10,040 in active trading. The Nasdaq was down 11 to 1819. This is NPR News. The conference board's index of leading economic indicators fell in July for the second month in a row. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The index, designed to help forecast economic activity 3 to 6 months in the future, fell by a larger-than-expected 0.3% in July. The drop followed a smaller decrease in June. Senior economist Scott Anderson of Wells Fargo says rising prices for energy and other goods are amplifying interest rates and cutting into the supply of money available. He's not worried about a recession, but thinks the second half of the year will bring slower economic growth.
The indicators we're seeing is that things are getting quite a bit softer than what I think even Alan Greenspan anticipated. And the soft patch is looking more like a briar patch right now.
The Labor Department said today that new unemployment claims dropped for the third week in a row. Anderson says he'll be watching closely to see if that translates to a jump in the number of new jobs. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
United Airlines said today that it will probably have to cancel and replace all its employee pension plans. The bankrupt air carrier filed papers in bankruptcy court saying it's considering the move as it tries to attract financing for its reorganization. If United defaults on its four employee pension funds, the obligations would have to be taken over by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is already tightly stretched for money. The agency has said United's pensions plans are underfunded by more than $8 billion. United said its financial position has been made even more difficult lately by soaring prices for jet fuel and by the government's refusal to guarantee $1.6 billion in loans the airline says it needs. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment. At visa.com/signature.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. A brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing against three African tribes in the Darfur region of western Sudan has driven more than 1 million people from their villages and killed tens of thousands. Attacks on the villagers continue by Arab militias supported by the pro-Islamic government of Sudan, and international observers warn that disease and malnutrition among the refugees could bring the death toll to the hundreds of thousands by year's end. Later in the program, we'll hear more about the roots of the conflict in Sudan. First, we'll speak with Rowan Gillies. He's international president of Doctors Without Borders, which has been working to improve health conditions among the Darfur refugees. Gillies is a surgeon from Sydney, Australia, who began working for Doctors Without Borders as a field doctor in Afghanistan. He recently visited Sudan and returned at the end of July. Among the sites he toured is a village called Mornay in western Darfur, where about 80,000 displaced people now live in a refugee camp. I asked him to describe what he saw when he walked through the camp.
You walk through, the children always follow you. The children are always excited to see Khawaja, which means white man in Arabic, and they follow you, talk to you, and chat to you. And then, but if you go and sit down in these small little huts, which are only about 5 feet high and maybe 8 feet wide, and they're covered in plastic tarpaulin, and there's a few sticks around it. And there's a little cooking pot there and a little, maybe a blanket, and usually a jerry can for water. And this is where three or four people live. And it's very hard to grasp what they feel about their future, where they're going, because they're stuck in a limbo, a life of limbo. When the camps don't have enough water, when there aren't latrines and they have to go and defecate in the field, when some of their family have had to go to the clinic because they're having constant diarrhea, when some members of their families have died in the mass displacement or they've died from the diseases from being so crowded afterwards. It's an incredibly vulnerable group of people. And I'm always surprised the dignity they still maintain. They still offer you in for a cup of tea. They even offer you food. And I feel incredibly guilty taking food from people who have very little food. However, I think the insult is greater for me to say, no, you're poor, I'm rich, I won't make it any worse for you.
What kind of food are you offered?
Beans, often the food that we've given out in distributions, or offer, usually a cup of tea, actually. A cup of tea and a bit of some beans or something. And I sit down, I don't eat very much, to be honest, and have a chat to them. But one of their abilities to keep their dignity is to keep behaving like they would in their normal lives. Their culture is to offer help to strangers and to offer hospitality to strangers, and I'm one of them, so they'll come and it's continuing their dignity, continuing their lives. But and the other thing I found very, very, very difficult to deal with was you go through the camps and you find a lot of elderly people. And when I say elderly, I mean 60, 65. They've gone through probably a number of displacements in their life because there have been difficulties in Darfur over the last 20, 30 years. And when the food comes to them, they often give it to their children because the children are vulnerable, or to the pregnant women. And they either don't have people to look after them or don't want people to spend too much time with them because they would rather look after the children. And they're often dying in these little camps with very little help and dying of starvation. And this is what we found. We started a little donkey cart going around the camp to look for people who cannot make it to the clinic, because we found that people were actually dying within their own structures. And on the first days the donkey came, there was elderly person after elderly person. we couldn't do a lot for them. Pretty much they had diarrhea, they were malnourished, so we brought them into the hospital, cleaned them up, gave them some food, have a bit of a chat, keep them in for a few days, and then take them home and try and make sure they've got a good food distribution for next time. So there's a lot of humanity still happening. There's a lot of children still laughing, and there's a lot of people getting on with their lives. But there's a basic underlying concern about where is their life going? What are they going to do in 6 months' time? And where is their next food coming from?
Give me a sense of the demographic makeup of the people that you've seen in the camps. I mean, are there old people, women, children?
Well, interesting, you should say. Yeah, interesting, because we've done a number of demographic studies and suggest there are disproportionately few numbers of men of what you call fighting age. And my impression is it's from two reasons. One is because there has been massive violence, and specifically the men have been killed. And secondly, the men are out trying to find food, whether they travel to Khartoum to get food or to get money and try and do things for their families. And the difficulty people face inside the camps on a demographic basis is quite stark. The men are too afraid to go outside the camp because they feel they will be killed by militias around them. The women of between the ages of, let's say, 12 and 40 have a reasonable chance of being raped if they go outside the camp. So it falls to the elderly women and the young children to go out to the camp to collect wood, to collect firewood and sometimes water. So people are coming across incredible decisional difficulties about what they should do. Should they send their men out to die or their children out to get beaten?
What kind of effort have international relief agencies been able to mount to relieve the suffering in Sudan?
Whenever you get displaced people, whatever the cause, I suppose there are a number of things you must address. Their housing, water, their sanitation, their medical care and their food. And different organisations have been involved in this. We are obviously much more focused on the medical side. But we've noticed that because of a lack of food, we've been forced to step into areas that we do occasionally, but not a lot. We certainly often help malnourished children, but at the scale, I think currently we have about 2,000 children under five in therapeutic feeding centres. That's an incredible amount of children in what you would describe as an intensive care situation. If they're not treated in this therapeutic fashion, they will die in the next 2 to 3 months.
That is to say, their malnutrition has reached a point where they require intense intervention.
Exactly right. It's sometimes between 5 and 7 meals a day and certain medical protocols. We give them antibiotics and vitamin supplements and so on. So there's a lot of children that have reached that level because of the lack of food assistance. There's also a large number. We have around about 10,000 children we're also treating in supplementary feeding centres. So they haven't got to the level of need in the therapeutic centres, but they're on the downward slope, and we'd rather catch them there than go to the point of the intensive feeding centres. And then we're doing what we call blanket feeding, which is basically every child under five gets a ration every 10 days or so. And this is a ration for them, but also for their family. The fact that we're doing so much what we call blanket feeding in this area suggests that there has been insufficient food distribution, general food distribution over the last 6 months.
Are the difficulties the result of opposition from the government and letting the food get there? I mean, does it come in through Sudan or does it come in through Chad?
Comes in mainly through Sudan, not through Chad. There were certainly administrative difficulties earlier in the year. They have really opened up a lot now, and you can get a visa and you can get access and trucks in much more easily at this stage. I think there's also the wet season makes it more difficult, but we knew it was coming, so planning for that I don't think has been adequate. And there's money required by the different groups to do it, so the donation requirement hasn't been enough. And as well, I think there's been sort of some intransigence amongst many organisations and slowness to react over this whole crisis. And I would include us in that. We were one of the first to respond to this, but we felt we were late ourselves in our response.
Why have people been slow to respond?
I think this getting into the areas was very difficult with administrative constraints, with visas and so on. But also, I think it's that reluctance. My impression is there's been a reluctance to jump into this man-made crisis and in all the political difficulties that it involves. Unfortunately, you can't sort of step back from these crises and allow group people to be sacrificed because you're very worried about getting too involved in politics. We're certainly not involved in the politics that are going on, but we are always a victim to the politics, I suppose, that of the world politics and the internal politics that happen within Sudan.
When you reflect on your experience in Sudan, is there one particular moment, one one experience that's left an enormous impression?
Yes, there's actually a few. I found after spending about a week in Darfur, I just reflected on the number of people I'd watched die, and it's sickening. It's sickening. Well, I'm watching a pregnant woman die of jaundice with a 4-month fetus inside, and there's very little you can do. And you look at the reasons why, and this it just didn't need to happen. And watching it's quite morbid in some ways, but watching someone die really concentrates you on the frustration and the anger you feel about what has happened to these people on many, many levels. It's not just the displacement, it's not the violence, it's everything, including the lack of assistance. And in many ways, the lack of caring from whether it be authorities or whether it be people in the rest of the world, that these people are going through these awful, awful times. And they will continue to do so over the next 6 months, probably over the next year or two. And the fact that it may not stop is incredibly upsetting.
Dr. Rowan Gillies. He's international president of Doctors Without Borders, and he recently visited the Darfur region of Sudan. He'll be back later in the show. Coming up, the origins of the conflict in Sudan. This is Fresh Air. Today we're examining the civil war and humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan, where more than 1 million people have been driven from their villages and tens of thousands have been killed. To explain the roots of the conflict, we turn to John Prendergast. He's followed events in Sudan for 20 years, and he's been involved with other humanitarian emergencies and civil wars in Africa. He was a member of the National Security Council in the Clinton administration, and he's currently a special advisor to the International Crisis Group. Prendergast was in the Darfur region of Sudan last month. I asked him to explain the origins of the conflict.
Well, as always, these wars are very, very complicated, and I think there are a few very elementary reasons why we're seeing a major war and then an ethnic cleansing that's resulted from it. There are environmental factors. Certainly in this part of the world, the Sahara Desert is encroaching. It's moving further and further south. This is disrupting the traditional land tenure patterns of both the agriculturalists and particularly the pastoral groups in Darfur. There are socioeconomic factors involved, of course, as certain groups are disadvantaged by this environmental change and disadvantaged by the economic changes that result from the environmental shifts. And then there are political reasons for the conflict, as certain groups perceive themselves to be marginalized and cut out of the political processes that govern the country. So all of these have led to a rebellion by what are primarily three ethnic groups that are African groups, they're not Arab groups, from Darfur. And these three groups have formed two different rebel movements, which have begun fighting in early 2003. And by April 2003, by April or May 2003, the government had responded by using these militia called Janjaweed as its principal means, its first line of defense. And by arming these Janjaweed and thus siding with one of the groups in the intense competition for resources and giving that group impunity and arming it and encouraging it to wipe out the civilian population of the rebels, we saw this extraordinary campaign of ethnic cleansing unfold.
Now, what is the Janjaweed's interest in attacking these African tribes?
Yeah, the Janjaweed have their roots in a racist ideology. They're a very small subsection in their origin of the larger Arab groups in Darfur. They're sort of a Ku Klux Klan version of the narrow opinion in Darfur that believes that the Arabs are the rightful owners of the land and should therefore drive African populations out of the area. So by siding with this narrow band of people, the government basically threw gasoline on a small fire. These Janjaweed were given impunity, were given freedom to do whatever they wanted to do, and they effectively burned down half of the villages in Darfur and displaced half of the people in Darfur and killed a very high percentage of them. So it's a remarkable war strategy on the part of the government. It was very effective, as a matter of fact, because it actually inhibits the rebels' ability to move around now because they don't have civilian support base anymore. But the impact on humanitarian terms and human rights terms is profound and really unmatched since we've seen since 1994's genocide in Rwanda.
Now, the Sudanese government has said, among other things, that the people in Darfur are victims of an old ethnic and tribal conflict that has really little to do with the central government. What concrete evidence is there that the Sudanese government is complicit in this campaign of massacres and ethnic cleansing?
Well, first of all, the government wants people to see this as a local conflict. They want to see it as a so-called tribal conflict. It's the strategy of the government throughout the country, because Darfur is not the only place, by the way, in Sudan that is on fire or has been on fire over the last 10 years. And so the government has tried to, rather than have people perceive the conflict as it rightly is, which is groups of people around the country which feel cut out of the political and economic processes in the country and who are rebelling against that government, they want them to see local conflicts where tribes are battling tribes and it's chaos and anarchy and they can do very little about it. And by taking sides with one group over another in an underlying economic conflict over resources, the government very wisely created additional tensions and hatreds now that will take generations to unfold and unravel. So they've been quite effective at what they're doing. In terms of their ability to, or their relationship with the Janjaweed, the evidence is accumulating. The Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International reports, as well as the reports by the group that I work for, the International Crisis Group, all have begun to document the very specific ties between the government in Khartoum and specific Janjaweed leaders who have received major arms shipments and then distributed those arms with specific instructions, have used government barracks, and most damning and most obvious in terms of evidence, have been backed in most of their attacks by government attack helicopters and government ground troops, and even high-altitude bombing by the Antonovs that the government uses. So it's been very coordinated. The government has supported these Janjaweed militias to attack, and it's backed them up just in case they run into any rebels. If it was just the Janjaweed attacking, it in fact may have been handled to some degree by the rebel forces. But because it was such a mismatch with both Janjaweed and government attacking, the rebels were simply overrun in many places and the civilian populations were devastated as a result.
What tactics did the Janjaweed and the Sudanese government use in attacking these villages? What exactly were they trying to do?
Well, in talking to refugees and in talking to internally displaced Sudanese all over the country, they come back with the same story, which begins early in the morning with an attack by a high-altitude government plane which drops a payload of bombs on a particular village. And that, of course, that will kill some people, but usually that's designed just to destabilize people. So they come running out of their huts and houses and rushing around in uncertainty about what's happened. Just as they're rushing out of their huts, the Janjaweed militia come in either on camels or on horseback, usually on camels, and start shooting and attacking civilians. Sometimes the raping starts right away. Sometimes they wait until the women have been collected in certain areas. But they're usually trying to kill the men and boys. And then if that's not enough, if that's not effective, or if lots of people are escaping, then we see the reports, the consistent reports of a government attack helicopter then being the third line, in effect, after the high-altitude bombing and then the Janjaweed attack. Then the helicopter moves in and starts shooting people that are running away firing missiles and exploding many of the structures remaining in the village. And this is usually overseen by government ground troops, which are off in the distance, who are watching the scenario unfold and are on standby just in case there's a rebel detachment there. So that's the pattern. It happens almost every time. At the end of that, usually the government tries to will move in and, along with the Janjaweed, and start a cleanup operation, in quotes, which involves having the bodies of the victims of the killing stuffed into the wells to make the water supply poison and thus the village uninhabitable for some time to come. So that's been the pattern that is documented over and over again by survivors of these attacks.
What do the Janjaweed hope to accomplish with this kind of brutality? I mean, are they in effect hoping to steal this land for their own herding activities in the future?
Yeah, I think that is precisely what is implied in the government's promise and the government's provision of impunity to them. They don't, of course, without being prosecuted for all these crimes and driving the non-Arab groups out of their villages, they now have access to that land. They don't want to live in these villages. They just want access to the pasture land. And because, again, and we go back to the earlier discussion about the encroachment of the Sahara Desert as it moves southward and reduces their space for watering their animals. They just want the freedom to roam into these areas, and it's becoming increasingly restricted. So I think this is a major advance for them and their economic agenda to be able to have a free rein now in terms of their grazing and pasture land for their animals. And not only that, and perhaps even more importantly, I mean, they've stolen tens of thousands of head of cattle, representing in dollar terms literally hundreds of millions of dollars of wealth. These were wealthy areas in Darfur, particularly in North Darfur. People had accumulated huge herds of livestock, particularly camels and in the southern part of Darfur, cattle. And these, you know, are tremendous savings accounts in effect for the communities. And all of them have been transferred now to the Arab groups that are involved with the Janjaweed. So these guys are major criminal networkers now, and they not only undertake their attacks there, but they also cross border into Chad to undertake cattle raiding and camel raiding there as well. And they sell their goods up into Libya and into the Gulf. So they've internationalized their criminal activity, and this is all with the full support of the government of Sudan.
John Prendergast. He's a former member of the National Security Council and a special advisor to the International Crisis Group. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with John Prendergast about the origins of the conflict in Sudan. Also, Rowan Gillies, International President of Doctors Without Borders, on the challenges humanitarian groups face in war-torn countries and why his organization has pulled out of Afghanistan after 24 years. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our conversation with John Prendergast about the conflict and humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan. Prendergast is a former member of the National Security Council and a special advisor to the International Crisis Group. When a government is accused of the kind of brutality and human rights violations that this one is, we often see behind it a particular strongman, if you will. We know little about the Sudanese government. Where did they come from? What kind of government is it?
Well, over the last 40 years, a small but growing movement, what they call Islamist movement, which would be a political Islam organization, formed and grew and penetrated the structures of the state in Sudan, the post-colonial state in Sudan. And finally, by 1989, they were ready to make their move to take power. They certainly couldn't in an election, because the only democratic election that had been held during the 1980s was one in which they only secured about 12% of the vote. So they had a very small base, but they engineered a coup in 1989 that took power and immediately began to introduce their vision of an Islamic state. And they destroyed all forms of opposition, drove the political parties out of the country and underground, crushed the unions, and they've basically been on a roll ever since then.
So is this a military regime? Are they isolated? Do they have international support?
Yeah, it's a military regime that has assiduously developed alliances within the Arab League over the years. It has allies in parts of Africa and it's been able to buy new allies as a result of its oil diplomacy. In other words, providing concessional rates to countries that it wants to be sympathetic towards it for whatever political purposes it has, can provide, because it's now a major oil exporter, can provide that energy at reduced rates. So it has some tools at its disposal to build friendships abroad, and those friendships have come in handy at times when the international pressure gets too hot, as it is now. And you have countries all over the world running interference for Khartoum on the Security Council and in other forums that lead other governments who are more concerned about human rights and humanitarian assistance very perplexed as to how to ultimately influence the government and the larger international community to try to take, again, more assertive action in response to the crisis there in Darfur.
Is the Taliban sort of a rough model for this kind of regime, or are they similar?
I think this regime in Khartoum is much more pragmatic. These guys have a desire to play ball in the international institutions, even while they're perpetrating actions at home that ought to get them thrown out of these institutions. And so I think that they're very, very different than the Taliban in their worldview. They're all educated in Europe and North America, and they desire to be accepted, and not only accepted, to be players, to act as a bridge between Africa and the Middle East, to be major actors in the Islamic world. So I think that they have these kinds of desires, which makes them somewhat permeable to pressure, and that's why there is some hope that you could actually influence this government. Whereas in Afghanistan, perhaps the Taliban was beyond influence.
Has this campaign of the Janjaweed and the government been effective in defeating or discouraging the rebel groups?
I think that the Janjaweed strategy, the government's use of the Janjaweed in attacking the support base of the civilians, has been dramatically successful. It has definitely eroded the rebels' ability to conduct military operations against the government. It's reduced the mobility of the rebels significantly, and it's made their opportunities for undertaking military actions against the government has just reduced those considerably. So yes, it's been a very effective strategy. The problem is that as effective as it's been in pure military terms, it will have backfired when all is said and done, because so many people, young people particularly, have lost so many family members that they feel the only future that they have is to join a rebel group one of the two rebel groups and fight against this government for as long as they can. Can't bring back their relatives, but certainly can exact some justice in their view. And so we interviewed many, many child soldiers as we were traveling throughout the throughout Darfur, and we just kept asking them, rebel soldiers, why did you join? Young kids, why did you join the rebels? And they said, because my father was killed, because my brother was killed, because my mother was raped. I had no choice. So the government, I think, overplayed its hand, successfully defeated or at least undermined the rebel support base, but has now driven thousands of young people into the arms of the rebels, which will create a hostile force to it for the coming years. It will make it much more difficult for this war to be resolved.
Our guest is John Prendergast. He's currently a special advisor to the International Crisis Group and recently visited the Darfur region of Sudan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Prendergast. He was a member of the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. He's currently a special advisor to the International Crisis Group and recently visited the Darfur region of Sudan. Well, John Prendergast, tell us what you saw when you were in Darfur this summer.
Well, we had a chance to talk to, most importantly, we had a chance to talk to refugees and people inside Darfur who've been displaced. Went with Samantha Power, the Harvard professor. And we went and traveled around the rebel-held zones of Darfur rather than the government-held areas, which if you go through that, you're often just on some kind of stage-managed tour. So we wanted to get a better sense from the people who had been victimized what really happened. So we got a chance to talk to people and really find out, you know, the extent to which they had suffered at the hands of these Janjaweed and government attacks. We also went to burned villages. We saw village after village that had been destroyed. We walked through those villages and we saw the remains of the lives the people had led before these brutal attacks, you know, decades and decades of evidence of their savings, you know, the huge grain stores that had been burned and all of the various personal items that people had accumulated were all left as people just rushed out of their houses to try to save themselves. And then we saw, quite disturbingly, a mass grave site in which young men had been brought up to a ravine and asked to lay down, obviously, in the ravine and then shot in the back of the head, lined up side by side. So we came back to Chad, of course, to talk more to the refugees who were there in the Chadian camps, and they just continue to validate the story after story of people who have been suffering in the hands of this government. And none of them want to go back unless there's an international force there to protect them. They won't go back as a result of the Sudan government providing more police. They won't go back based on government promises that they won't do anything or anymore to these villages. They will only go back if there are international guarantees in the form of troops that will protect people from the marauding militias and the government forces that have displaced them in the first place.
How has the United States' involvement with Iraq and Sudan's ties to other Arab regimes affected the situation?
Well, I think in the Security Council, in the United Nations Security Council, for example, the United States is unwilling to utilize some of the leverage it has to try to get other countries to go along with our agenda, which would be an agenda that would be more forceful in its pressure on the government of Sudan. It's unwilling to exercise that leverage because we want to save that leverage for Iraq. They're not going to tell you that, but that's a clear dynamic, and everyone realizes it in New York. And then on the ground, we have a great deal of trouble convincing governments throughout the Middle East that, in fact, there is a crisis in Darfur. Remember, this is the same administration here in Washington that brought you Secretary Powell with his dramatic speech and presentation of all the intelligence on Iraq in advance of the vote that allowed the use of force. So I think people are very skeptical, especially in the Middle East, very skeptical of what the United States says about these kinds of things. And the Sudan government has assiduously courted Arab opinion in the most dramatic terms, saying the United States simply wants to invade our country. They want to do the same thing they did to Iraq. Help us. Don't let them do this. And a number of countries have responded to this. So it's become a very, very difficult global environment for more assertive action in Darfur right now.
A lot of Americans remember that during the 90s, Al-Qaeda had operations in Sudan. Does the Sudanese government still have ties to Islamic militant groups? And how does that affect this?
It's a very murky picture. The Sudan government, in response to the sanctions that were placed on it by the Clinton administration and by the Security Council during the 90s, slowly disengaged. They threw bin Laden out. They asked many of the other groups that were housed in Sudan to leave. Over time, this cooperation with the United States escalated in the aftermath of September 11 attacks, because the government in Khartoum was worried that they might be the next target after Afghanistan. And so I think that at this point, the ties remain minimal to major groups that are threatening Western interests. However, there are reports all the time of the use of the territory of Sudan for both training and transit by not only Al-Qaeda elements, but other groups as well, particularly Palestinian groups. And so I think that it remains an issue of concern, perhaps even grave concern, to those working on the counterterrorism efforts here in Washington as well as other parts of the world. But it is not the problem that it posed in the early to mid-1990s before it was pressured into changing its behavior.
The UN Security Council has finally taken some action on the situation in Sudan. What exactly have they done, and how effective will it be?
Well, the Security Council passed a resolution at the very end of July, which, by the way, was the first resolution that they passed on this situation in Darfur, despite the fact that the ethnic cleansing had been ongoing for 16 months. So it was very late. And it was a very weak response. It effectively said that it warned the government. It said there may be some consequences if you don't improve the humanitarian situation, if you don't protect civilians, if you don't start peace talks. But it didn't specify what those actions would be. So we got a very, very weak resolution, which the only operative phrase was to impose sanctions on arms sanctions on non-governmental organizations in Sudan. That means the rebels, who were the only groups that can, in fact, protect civilians, are now subject to an arms embargo, but the government is not. So at this point, they have a 30-day deadline, the government does, to respond to some of the requests that the Security Council has made with respect to civilian security and humanitarian assistance. And unfortunately, though, the next week, the United Nations Security Secretary General Kofi Annan sent his new special envoy, a Dutch diplomat named Jan Pronk. He sent him there, and Pronk negotiated an agreement with the government that gave them another 30 days. And he basically said, well, we don't really think that the government can succeed in implementing all the things that the Security Council wants it to do in this short of time period. It's unrealistic to think it could. So it just took the wind out of the sails of the Security Council action. The UN undercut itself, and I think the Sudan government is laughing as it continues to wage a terror campaign in Darfur.
In your view, what would it take to ensure the safety of these villagers and reverse this human suffering? I mean, are we talking about American troops?
I don't think the Americans need to be involved. I think that that at this point, the African forces that have volunteered to deploy to the refugee camps and the internally displaced camps throughout Darfur and Chad would be a sufficient deterrent to further attacks by both the Janjaweed militias and the government forces. The Rwandans and the Nigerians and Tanzanians and others who have promised that they could send forces, I think would be more than enough to protect civilians and give them the confidence that over time they could return to their villages and try to rebuild their lives. I think the United States presence, it would be a very disruptive one, that it would draw elements from Iraq down to Sudan for soft targets, and we would be in a situation which would just divert attention from the fundamentally important imperative now of just protecting people and protecting their livelihoods and their return to their homes. And I think that the African troops that are volunteering for this job can do the job, and I don't think they need to have necessarily a major deployment of Western forces to be involved in that, although what they will need is provisions, logistics, equipment, and all the kind of things that will allow them to do their job well. And that the United States has to lead on. We have to be the, I think, first and foremost provider of that kind of assistance to allow those troops to do their job.
And as somebody who's watched Sudan for, I guess, almost 20 years, I'm kind of wondering at what frustration you feel at seeing this gathering crisis.
Well, if the international, the leaders of the international community wouldn't make such beautiful speeches, I think I would be less frustrated. But every single one of the leaders of the countries on the Security Council, in the European Union, and particularly here in the United States, have made very, very dramatic speeches about the importance of never again in the context of Rwanda and its 10th anniversary, and in the context of even in Sudan and preventing the destruction from continuing. But they're not willing to undertake the kind of action to back up these pledges, and I think that is a tremendously frustrating thing for all of us who are trying to respond to this. But it's got to be just heartbreaking and soul-breaking for the people of Darfur as they hear on their radios, as they're huddled in these refugee camps and these displaced camps, all these wonderful speeches that are made. Even visitors that come, the Secretary General of the United Nations, the Secretary of State of the U.S., who came to Darfur and said, we won't let this continue, and then they just don't do anything about it. So I think that it is even more crushing for them than it is for all the people around the world who are trying to bring attention to what is happening in Darfur. And we have to remember those victims as we wonder what our world leaders are willing to do to stop it.
Well, John Prendergast, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Prendergast. He's a special advisor to the International Crisis Group on the crisis in Sudan. Coming up, more from Rowan Gillies, international president of Doctors Without Borders, on the group's recent decision to pull out of Afghanistan. This is Fresh Air. Earlier in today's show, we spoke with Rowan Gillies, the international president of Doctors Without Borders. Let's get back to that interview. Gillies is a surgeon from Sydney, Australia. He recently returned from a tour of refugee camps and villages in the Darfur region of Sudan. Doctors Without Borders is a humanitarian group that maintains strict neutrality, but their relief efforts are often hampered by local government officials pursuing a political agenda. How do you maintain your neutrality when you feel fury at political leaders?
I think being Australian, I have a cynicism for all political leaders, so you tend not to take sides on any political side. So you certainly feel frustration about what has happened to them, but the machinations that go into these the creation of these contexts are not simple, and I think you can't necessarily find one person to blame or even one group to blame. But certainly you feel anger and you feel a degree of solidarity. But you do know that this is happening in many other parts of the world, and it's happening aggression from many different sources. So you learn to deal with it, I think, and look after your patient and do what you can. But I suppose the way we do it in our organisations, we channel it into coming back to places like Washington or to Europe and saying, this is unacceptable. What is happening is completely unacceptable. The people that are responsible, the national government has responsibilities to their people, the international community has responsibility, and humanitarian organisations have responsibility. So I think that anger and that incredible concern about about what's happening, you can channel that into something, and it can channel into trying to make the conditions a little better for these people so they can keep living.
Dr. Gillies, your group, Doctors Without Borders, recently ended its 24-year involvement in Afghanistan. Tell us what led to that decision.
Well, ultimately, the decision was brought about because five of our workers were murdered about 2 months ago in Baghis province in Afghanistan.
Tell us about that incident. Yeah.
Pretty much there were five people, three expatriate and two Afghans, who were returning from their clinic where they've been working during the day, and we understand that they were attacked and shot and killed. This, obviously, this is one of the most difficult times we've had as an organisation, that we've been attacked and we've lost so many of our people that we've worked with for so long. And the most important thing, I think, is for their families and their friends that they've lost their loved ones. Unfortunately, it also sends a signal about what has been happening in Afghanistan and different parts of the world. Since that killing, we've been named by a spokesman who says he's working for the Taliban a number of times as targets. So as an aid organisation, we've been named as a target by one of the warring parties. This is a situation we cannot work, a condition under which we can't work. As well, the follow-up of the murder of these people has not gone ahead in the way we thought we would like with respect to investigating what happened and trying to find out who perpetrated these killings. Without some sort of show from governments, whether they be overseas government or the national government, that it's unacceptable to attack humanitarian workers, again, we can't work.
I gather that their suspects have been identified in this case, right?
Yeah, people have told us. I mean, we're obviously not an investigative organisation. People have told us they do have suspects, but we haven't seen very much progression along those lines. But this is on a background of many, many, many attacks on aid workers in the last year or two in Afghanistan, and very few of them have been follow-up in a judicial sense. So it's not just what's happening to the case of our people who were murdered, but also many other cases. The difficulty we have, it brings up a much greater question, is how can you work independently in the current world situation with the war on terror or so on? And the difficulty is that as an independent actor, we rely for our security on the fact that both sides of the war understand who we are and understand that we're only there to help people. We're not part of the fight. Currently in Afghanistan, we have on the one side, the coalition, who has co-opted humanitarian action. They said, yes, we are part of the humanitarian response. We are humanitarians, and denying us our independence, I suppose. And the other side of the conflict is we have people who've targeted us. So on both sides, it's been very difficult for us to work. And I can give you an example of that loss of independent space to work is the earlier this year, the coalition forces handed out leaflets to people in Afghanistan saying, if you don't hand in Al-Qaeda, if you don't hand in Taliban leaders, your aid will be cut off. And that message, conditioning aid on military or political desires, makes our position almost impossible. It's very hard for us to go the next day and say, yes, we want to give you aid. They say, well, no, are you part of this coalition? Are you part of the people who bombed here last year? No, we're not. We're not with us or against us. We're right in the middle, and that's where we want to stay.
You, I assume, protested this to the coalition government.
Yes, very strongly. And they said, well, sorry, it was a mistake. It was the people on the ground made that mistake. But it's happened time and again. And when there's this mixing, blurring of the lines, it's very difficult for us to define who we are and define our security boundaries, saying we are not part of one of the warring parties. We are completely independent of these.
Secretary of State Colin Powell said in addressing this issue of humanitarian relief in 2001, he said, and this is a quote, "Just as surely as our diplomats and military, American non-governmental organizations are out there serving and sacrificing on the front lines of freedom, these non-governmental organizations are such a force multiplier for us, such an important part of our combat team." What did you think when you heard those words?
As an organization, we're very upset by that statement. It's very hard for us to explain to people on the field, intelligent people in the field, our patients and so on, that when we're described as force multipliers or part of the war against terror or whatever, that no, we're not. We're actually independent actors. It affects our security and affects our ability to access different areas and help people. And there was a... I was reading the New York Times a couple of days ago, and there was an article which suggested the United States government was preparing a list of militia leaders relying on information culled from private release organizations working there. Now, I can assure you, Doctors Without Borders is certainly not compiling information on militia leaders. And for the government to come out and say this and say this to a journalist, it again puts us at great security risks and makes it very difficult for us to get on with our work. If different parts of the warring faction feel we're not independent, it's very hard for us to work without changing the way we work and, again, working non-independently. And it's incredibly disappointing for the people of Afghanistan that people who have come to help them from overseas just cannot get there anymore.
Well, Rowan Gillies, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Rowan Gillies is International President of Doctors Without Borders. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chellug, and Megan Howell. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair, and by Bantam Books, publisher of Retirement for Two, Everything You Need to Know to Thrive Together as Long as You Both Shall Live, by Marianne Vandervelde, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The theme from The Magnificent Seven, one of the best-known film themes by composer Elmer Bernstein, who's died at the age of 82. On the next Fresh Air, we remember him and his work. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.